אני לדודי ודודי לי. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. I'm Pastor Rob, and welcome to the Ponder a New podcast. We took a big break this past summer, but we're going to pick back up looking at one book of the Bible each week. And what a book we have to get started with here, Song of Solomon. Some of you may not have heard of this book. It's more or less an erotic poem, maybe even an erotic theatrical piece, talking about a king and a maiden and their desire, kind of raw desire for each other. So we're going to have some fun with this and ultimately, I think, get to how this is a metaphor somehow for God and us. But without further ado, let's get pondering.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Which way has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins, and not one among them is bereaved.
I had a lot of fun debating which passage to ask my wife to read here for the Song of Solomon's. She's the one who often reads the scripture for this podcast. And that's because, well, there are some nice quotes like, I am my beloved's and my beloved's is mine. Yeah, pretty quickly you get into a lot of pretty racy, if not pornographic, downright erotic stuff. And it was kind of funny to ask Emily, hey, could you read this? What to do with the book? Here we have the Song of Solomon. It's kind of one of those puzzling books you kind of scratch your head and you say, why is this book in the Bible? It doesn't really mention God. It's just, again, a lot of pretty graphic sexual imagery that, I mean, at one point it seems like there's a marriage, but there seems to be something going on before the marriage, and there seems to be, are they all, is it just one woman and one man, or are there other people involved? And what's with the friends in the, or kind of almost the chorus here, like, and there's a sister, like, what's going on? And Jesus, and really none of the New Testament directly quotes from Song of Solomon. So what in the world is going on here? I'd like to offer that the book of Song of Solomon is almost like a Rorschach test. The Rorschach test where you get those kind of like ink blots and the psychiatrist asks you what you see. And it's designed to kind of get at your subconscious because people see so much into this book. And that's because in many ways, and we'll get there, although there is kind of a normal or dominant interpretation, the fact that it never was sort of, well, it's not talked about in a lot of the other parts of the Bible. And the New Testament, again, never comments on it. So it's not like there's any definitive, this is the way we have to understand this Old Testament passage here. And well, for some people, I was reading this one commentary that this was by a feminist biblical scholar, and she was arguing that the Song of Solomon was about how women could be assertive and have a stronger role within relationships, including sexual relationships, because of the forward nature of the woman. And it's not just that she's being pursued, but that she pursues. Or Martin Luther, when writing about this, decided that in spite of the fact that everything clearly is about sex here, that it wasn't about sex, which is kind of strange because Luther is normally pretty willing to talk about matters related to the sixth commandment. But Luther writes that it's a treatise on government and how Solomon was talking about how the ruler should guide and care for the people. Not quite sure. That there's a reason why that's not one of Luther's more famous commentaries. And also the Jewish people who have kind of used actually this Bible passage over the years, they read it over Passover. And Passover is this huge Jewish event, this festival that commemorates the people being led out of slavery into the wilderness and ultimately the promised land, and that exodus out of Egypt and the Passover, the passing over of the angel of death and so forth. And this huge Jewish holiday, and they actually read from Song of Solomon. So, yeah, and actually there's all these rabbinic commentaries seeing all of these allusions to the book of Exodus throughout the book of Song of Solomon. So I kind of feel like, you know, whatever you want to see here is kind of revealing kind of probably of your subconscious desires. Another interpretation, and I want to sort of play with this one a little bit, is, first of all, there's a cottage industry out there, people that read something in the kind of cauldron of cultural religion in the near Middle East. So what we would call Mesopotamia, the Levant, kind of what we would call basically the Middle East today, or maybe Egypt and including Greece and Turkey. And they discover something that existed in those ancient religions, whether it's a Zeus or Osiris, or more likely, again, the various Canaanite or Mesopotamian deities. And then they try to say how the Bible relates to this. And they often do so in a very derogatory way, kind of saying that these original kind of cultic and pagan stories somehow were juicier, or again, more socially equitable, or better through some feminist or sexual freedom lens, or whatever the lens may happen to be. But the point is that you have to find some near ancient myth and then explain how it relates to the Bible, and bonus points if you can critique why Scripture didn't get it right, and why we should have had this sort of pagan myth as the enduring one instead. But what's actually fascinating about, and there's kind of almost a case study here in the Song of Solomon, is that there's plenty of erotic poetry in the ancient world. And there's one story that involves two kind of Mesopotamian deities. One is Ishtar, maybe you've heard that name. And these other kind of, again, if you're familiar with the Epic of Gilgamesh, or this kind of whole, kind of that whole pantheon of gods. And what's fascinating is that again and again, what you actually see when you really get into it and you study these other Near East ancient myths, what you begin to see is not so much the similarity between the Bible and those stories. I mean, they're kind of related, people at campfires and caravans or trading stories over a millennia or more in these areas. But again and again, the Jewish view of their God, how they, and we would want to say kind of piously through the Spirit, came to understand who their God was just vastly different. And you see this again and again. So for instance, like in the Noah story and the rainbow, there are other flood stories in many other cultures, including Mesopotamian. But when you get into that story, you see how the image of God that emerges in Genesis is very different than the image of God that emerges in those other Mesopotamian stories. Chiefly that the God of the Old Testament makes a promise of peace and kind of goodwill ultimately. Again, there's so much there. So if you really do want to get into it, you can actually study these other religions, then study Judaism, and then see like, oh, actually there's something different. Or study Greco-Roman culture and study Jesus and say, okay, they're not all the same, all these religions. There's something different about the way the Jews are understanding their God And then on top of that, the way the Christians are looking at God was very different than sort of the cultures surrounding them. And in this case, they're, again, these kind of pagan sort of erotic stories that may even relate to sort of this drama between two heavenly beings and their kind of relationship. But that's not how the Jews think about God, that it would be sort of this male and female God. And so rather the way that they begin to understand it is that this book is a metaphor for God's relationship with the people. Again, the other near Middle Eastern understandings, you know, erotic poetry, God's doing all sorts of fantastic things that we as humans can only imagine doing. Wouldn't it be great, you know, prayers for fertility and beauty and so forth. But for the ancient Jews, this was a story about God's faithfulness, about, again, how God binds himself and loves and is willing to kind of pursue and make sacrifices for the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, and in the same way then the peoples should be devotion for their one true and only God. And then Christians, sort of hearing that interpretation, then saw that in their own scriptures, Christ is the groom and the church is the bride. This is in Ephesians or in Revelation. There's again this imagery of a bridegroom and so forth in some of the parables in the New Testament. And so the Christians then began to look at this book and say, this is a story, this is a metaphor, an allegory, describing the love of Jesus and his church. Kind of we're the new Israel in the church. And so that's, again, kind of how we arrive at our sort of dominant, what you might call normative understanding of this passage as in this book as a metaphor for God and us as humans in really more tightly Christ and the church. So let's play with that then. Scripture clearly presents a metaphor of husband and wife for God's relationship with the people. This is done in many different books in many different ways. And if the primary metaphor is of marriage, what's going to be emphasized there is the capacity of God or God and the people to somehow move forward together in spite of life's bumps and challenges. The image of a marriage that endures is one of steadfastness and faithfulness, a capacity to, again, absorb the bumps and blows of life, even those self-inflicted or inflicted upon each other. It's about a capacity to forgive. I was reading this article and it was talking about how what makes marriage successful actually isn't the ability to work it out, but the ability to live with the fact that it wasn't worked out. You know, the fact you're not going to change your spouse. They are who they are, and you sort of have to kind of deal with that. And there are certain parts of their personality that are chafing and frustrating, both to them and to you. So if the marriage metaphor is a really strong one, there's something beautiful about that in that it emphasizes an enduring, steadfast love. And you could argue that the most important word or the word that best describes the relationship of God to the people in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word chesed. And chesed is sometimes translated as steadfast love. But it's a really deep and broad word in the sense of it means the kind of love that endures for millennia in spite of the unfaithfulness of the other party. So there definitely is a way in which the Old Testament wants to or uses love language, kind of marriage language, partnership language, to talk about God's care and provision for the people, whether in the sort of the story that tells that or in the Psalms that declare it and so forth. But in the Song of Solomon, we're not praising and thinking about marital, enduring love, partnership love here. What we're thinking about is more the idea of being in love, of that passionate excitement for the other person. There's something intoxicating, exhilarating about being in love. You know, that stage of a relationship where you know, you're just kind of nervously waiting for their response back, you know, and you sort of want to get off work because you want to see them. And if you know that they're picking you up at, you know, 6 o'clock, and you're just kind of watching the time slowly, and you've prepared yourself, and, you know, if you're maybe cologne, perfume, nice clothing and all that stuff, there's a hymn, "Soul, now adorn yourself with gladness." But the word "adorn" there in the German, the original language of the tune, is schmucken, and that means to kind of like put on jewelry. It's even closely akin to the word for put on makeup. The idea is like to make yourself beautiful. And I think there's something kind of striking about that language if we begin to think about that in terms of our relationship with God. Because Song of Solomon's, if it's a metaphor, it's not a metaphor about the slow, steadfast, grinding love that endures. This is that passionate, I just can't wait to be with you, and my whole kind of body and mind are just thinking and drawn to you. And what would it be like if we were to say, like, I'm in love with God? Not just I love God, but I'm in love with God. Or the other way around, God, what if we told children, God doesn't love you, but God is in love with you? Right? That has a really different feel to it. And in some ways, this is the way that Paul will talk about God. He talks about God not counting our trespasses. And I was thinking about that in terms of, you know, language around beloved and falling in love. Because when you're falling in love with a person and you're in love, you don't even forgive them yet. You just simply ignore and excuse away their mistakes. You know, other of your friends are looking at you, or your parents or your siblings, like, what do you see in this guy or this girl? And, you know, you just see, like, you know, God's gift to the world in this other person. One of the great days for a human is when one of their friends finally dumps or is dumped by their ex that you didn't like, and you finally can give that speech. I mean, you got to make sure that the relationship really is severed, but you can finally give the speech about how, you know, she or he wasn't good enough for you anyway, and you get to rattle off all of their, you know, weaknesses and mistakes and failures of character, and it's kind of relish, like you've been waiting for months to unload on how much of a schmuckety schmuck this person was, but they were too in love and they just couldn't see the faults. That's a kind of a beautiful image for the way that God would think about us. That God thinks about you in a way like one who's intoxicated with kind of puppy love, so to speak, that God just overlooks your faults. And God doesn't kind of care about them. And if somebody asked God about you and said, well, what about this, this, and this? God would become defensive and instantly come to your, not as the cruel judge, but as the convinced lover of your beauty and your perfection and your awesomeness. And that's, I think, a really kind of a beautiful way to think about our relationship with God, that God, covers up our mistakes and is joyously waiting to spend time with us. Right? That God is just kind of counting down the seconds until we return to prayer, till we return to open communication. And God is just waiting kind of to hear, you know, more about our day and about our life and to kind of bond and connect with us. It also might say something about our relationship toward God. And what would it look like for us to pine after God? To just count down the seconds until we can spend time in prayer. And maybe there are parts of our life where we begin to savor so much our time with God that we just, again, pine away and just can't wait for those moments of prayer. I realize that talking about being in love with God is probably new language for many of us, but I just wanted to kind of play around with that, and I'd be curious for what you think of that idea of God being in love with us, or what would it mean for us to be in love with God. Have I desexualized the book too much, though? I mean, again, it is erotic poetry. Well, I'll leave with a thought here. And that is that, again, going back to the way in which Judaism has a lot of stories and myths and kind of commonalities with the other religions of its day, but yet somehow had a distinct identity. And in other ancient religions, gods were often having sex with each other and with humans. And often if they had sex with humans, it was often not consensual. And Israel stays away from that. They desexualize God, right? They don't have an idea that God is having sex with other gods or something. But maybe Song of Solomon reminds us that Judaism and the Hebrew Bible never desexualized humanity. Again, their understanding of God was that God was not inherently sexual with how God related to people, but that humans were definitely allowed to be. And in fact, you know, the first command of human is to be fruitful and multiply. I mean, the first command, the first thing we're told to do is to go have sex. And, you know, the first sort of story is the first words out of a man's mouth are about how beautiful his wife is. They have a big fight, and then they have makeup sex, and then they get pregnant. And then it doesn't take long after that till the first family, and the whole story of the first family is driven around Sarah's sexuality and her fertility and her attractiveness to other people, and then Abraham's choice to have sex with a concubine because Sarah wanted him to, and then that obviously ruined everything. And then that Abraham's got to go find a wife for his son, and his son is comforted by basically having sex with his wife after his mother died, and this is what comforts him. And then his son, Jacob, ends up sleeping with the wrong sister on the wedding night because he's drunk, and then has to marry her, and then has to work for 7 more years so he can have sex with the sister that he really wanted to. I mean, it's hard not to see that the characters in the Bible are very much interested in each other and having sex. The point, what I'm trying to make here, is that maybe it's okay that Song of Solomon is there just to remind us that, yes, the God of Scripture is a God who's not interested in us as sexual beings for himself. That God is not going to have sex with other gods, so that's not where God is, but that for the human realm, that this is totally fine. Now, that said, obviously the Bible is going to have a lot to say and a lot to figure out about what are the proper boundaries of sexual interaction. And that would be more than just this podcast. But suffice to say for right now that Song of Solomon, the erotic nature of it, is a reminder that while Israel's God, our God, is not a sexual God, that God in God's infinite wisdom and joy and delight is okay with human sexuality. That should probably be enough for us to ponder.